This is Petra Searle, recorded at the Marguerite Bay reunion in Bowness on Windermere by Chris Alden Lee on the 7th of November 2009.
My full name is Margaret Petra Searle. My place of birth is Exeter, Devon, and my date of birth is the 2nd of December
1928. What did your father do?
He was in the consular service, and retired from the consular service, having done a full service in 1919, and met my mother about 8 years later. And so he was very elderly when I was born. He was 64, and my mother was 42, so I had very old parents, which actually carries a few disadvantages to a young person. And his family were quite a lot of them in the consular service, scattered through the Americas. He finished up in Boston as consul general there. And when Derek and I came back from the Falklands in the beginning of 1959, we had 6 weeks in South America, sort of vaguely calling on one or two relations who I don't think quite believed I existed.
Really?
But there was one particularly, I mean, a cousin had, I think he was two generations below me, had started the Grange School in Santiago. And when we got there, he had just died. But his mother was still alive, and she was my first cousin. She was 82, and I was 30 then. So it was all rather strange, actually. But I haven't kept in touch with them, or they with me. So
what was your education like?
Well, it was wartime. I mean, I was brought up in Northwood, Middlesex, and went to school there. And then the war broke out when I was 10. And because it was just my mother and me, we self-evacuated. And then came back again, because it was the phony war. And then we went down to the south coast, and I went to a school my mother fancied down there. And then France fell, and it was fairly vulnerable. It was in Swanage. So we self-evacuated to Cornwall for a rather marvellous winter, actually, in Cornwall, where she was billeting officer, and I went to a little class. I think she then got a bit worried about my education and decided that invasion was slightly sort of in the air, well, more than slightly in the air, that perhaps I ought to go to school where I knew somebody. And I had some very great friends from Northwood, whose whole family, four girls, had all been to a school, Mora House, which is an Eastbourne school, evacuated to the ferry hotel here, the other side of the ferry on Windermere. So we came up here, and I went to school there. And she took a job as a matron in another school, what is now Blackwell. Well, it was Blackwell, but it's now the Arts and Crafts Centre.
Did he go on to further education?
Yes. The time up here was immensely happy, and I made lots of wonderful friends there. War was a blessing in disguise to me. Yes, I then messed about a bit. I had a year in an art school in Cambridge, and a year in a secretarial college in London. And then I went to Nottingham University to read geography, where I had 4 years there because I hadn't got a high school certificate. And so I did intermediate before I did a degree.
What was your first awareness of this strange place called the Antarctic?
Well, I was always interested in sort of slightly freaky, faraway places. Because my mother had a great friend who was on an Everest, the first Everest expedition.
The Mallory?
No, the one before that.
Oh, right.
I think 1921, the doctor, and he died on it. So, you know, I didn't know a lot about it, but Everest was my interest then. And 1953, of course, was the conquest, and that was the year I started work at DOS. And I suppose it was quite an easy switch to get interested in the Antarctic. When I first went to DOS, well, when I left university, I'd only got a 2-2, and there's not a lot you can do with a geography degree if you don't want to teach. So I took the civil service exams, where everybody who's done it comes out in a long, long list, and those with the highest marks get the Foreign Office and that sort of thing, and I got the Inland Revenue. So I needed a job, so I went to the Inland Revenue in Kilburn.
But not for long.
Well, about a bit less than a year later, I saw in the Times a series of jobs, a sort of little hierarchy of records officer, map officers, junior map officers, etc., of I think it was 9 people required at the Directorate of Colonial Service, as it was then. And I thought, that sounds much more interesting. So I applied and got an interview. Actually, I had a very good interview. The on the interviewing board was the civil director of military survey, and he took me on. He wanted me to tell him how I would do a major triangulation of Africa, and I said, I have no idea, and I'm not going to. And he went on and on. And I said, we're wasting our time, you know, I can't tell you. And apparently that sort of did the trick, because I discovered afterwards that the only ones who were interviewed were firsts and upper seconds. But because I was already as an established civil service, they had to interview me. So it's funny little things that change your life, actually. If I hadn't gone to the Inland Revenue, I would not have got that job.
Oh, good.
So, yes, sort of with a rather change of heart, I started work at Tolworth, along with this little hierarchy of people who've remained my friends, and one of whom was Derek, my husband. So neither of us had ever heard of FIDS in those days, and he was working in the map library, and I had been taken on as the deputy director, who was really the director of the organisation at Tolworth as opposed to the field, as his PA. I think he liked my sort of stubbornness or refusal to be put off.
Well, this is a new unit, a new initiative?
At the directorate, yes. Well, it was expanding. And I think he thought they needed someone with a geographical background, as opposed to surveyors and cartographers and the like, to keep their records and supply their material and sort things out. But it was a bit more than that. There were quite a few jobs that came along, sort of one-off jobs. I mean, one was land use in British Honduras, and one man would be sort of dealing with this. And I'd ask the directorate if they would make the map and he could work in with them. And I would be the liaison for this sort of thing, which was fascinating, actually, because there were all sorts of little jobs that came my way like that. One of which was South Georgia and Duncan Coss, and I had quite a lot to do with the South Georgia survey, a great deal to do with it, actually.
Can you elaborate?
Do you know a bit about the South Georgia survey?
Pretend I don't.
Pretend you don't. Well, it was, the main part was a 3-year organisation, 3 summers. And the first summer was before I got there. The second summer, there was one or two surveyors, whose names I won't mention, but they were sort of, I mean, it was a huge task, actually, to do a survey. South Georgia is so rugged. Nothing very much happened, or fairly unsatisfactory, and there were sort of frictions. You've probably heard of Dick Barton, Duncan Coss, and his temperament, but I found him very easy to work with, actually. And then the directorate funneled into his organisation Tony Bomford, who was son of Guy Bomford, who was Director General of the Ordnance Survey previously, who was a high-powered and amazing person for the amount of work he could get through. And he and Stan Patterson, who was his junior on that third-year survey, they did a wonderful job. Tony went on to be Director General of the Australian Land Survey. And Stan Patterson, I believe, is still in Canada, working there. But anyway, that was a really fascinating thing in which they did all the work, but I funneled it into the cartographers, and the problems sort of went to and fro, and the names problems came through me and went to the Foreign Office and things. So one of the jobs that I was doing among these little odd jobs was looking after the Antarctic things, which was not very much at the time. When I got there, there were two surveyors who'd been recruited, Norman Leppard and Dick Kenny, who I really just met before they sailed away in the old John Biscoe, I think, the really old John Biscoe. And they were both recruited from surveyors at the Ordnance Survey. They weren't fully qualified surveyors at all. And they seemed very young and to be going off to the Antarctic. But I didn't think that much about them. I mean, we wouldn't see them again for 2.5 years because the surveyors went to the directorate before they went south, appraised themselves of what there was to know and planned their work, well, this more so as time went on, and then after their 2 years came back and finished off their surveys. So Norman and Dick, I didn't see for another 2.5 years. But the following spring, two surveyors came back from the Antarctic, who were Ken Blakelock and David Stratton. And it was chalk and cheese, you know. And those who go, I thought, does this do something? I mean, I didn't realise that in a way they were rather special surveyors. David Stratton had been in the Antarctic world. He'd grown up in it. His godfather was Lord Mount Evans. And Ken had already done two trips down there. But I remember when I came into my office that morning, I think I knew they were coming, but anyway, they were seated in my office. One was sitting on my desk and one was sitting on my mat table. They had bowler hats on the end of their umbrellas, and they were twiddling them they were obviously sort of trying to make a funny of it all. Anyway, they became very good friends. And it was through them and Derek's friendship with Ken that he began to think, well, the Antarctic's much more exciting than the Director of OSO Survey's map library. I want to go there.
That was Derek's thinking.
Yes. So, that was the summer of 1954, and he recruited that autumn when they were expanding the number of bases. This is political rather more than anything else. Brian Roberts at the Foreign Office was keen to sort of dot them right the way down the peninsula. And they chartered the Norsel to take a sort of a second batch down. They didn't actually leave London till January 55. So, yes, Derek was on that ship.
Was all this map-making also political?
Not entirely. I mean, yes, I suppose it was in a way. I mean, it certainly wasn't development in those days in the Antarctic. You do need maps for talking about almost anything. And DOS supplied maps to FIDS, as they were then, for free. There was no money between different government departments. It was just completely straightforward. And I think one reason why they were so keen to do it, my boss was very keen to do it, because in the early days of DOS, it was very difficult when you take on mapping the colonies to have much to show in the early days, because mapping is a long, drawn-out process to get the triangulation and everything done to actually having a map in front of you. But the Antarctic ones were extremely quick to do, because the early ones were not mapped as such. It was whatever anybody had done before sort of fudged together. And I was the fudger in some which is about my level of survey knowledge. There were a lot of jokes on that for score. I was definitely a person for my time, and I finished at the right time, I think, when more professional things came in. And all these things had to, all these fudges and maps and things, and the production was quite quick. Mm. And so it put the DOS figures up, you know, map production for the year 54 was suddenly sort of started rocketing. Too many questions were not asked about the quality of some of the maps. But all those maps had to go to be approved before they could be printed to the Foreign Office, Brian Roberts and Ina Thomas. So I used to trot them off, and we'd talk about them, and he'd pick holes in them, and they'd be put right. And at the same time, I used to go for other sort of questions to FID Scientific Bureau, which was the science arm of FIDs in those days. I mean, FIDs was largely run by the Crown agents in this country and directed by the governor in the Falkland Islands. But as far as supplies and that sort of thing, it was all contracted to the Crown agents Barbara Wells was the sort of link woman between this who organised these things. And the Scientific Bureau was, well, presumably they started realising there was science coming back, and it was set up in Queen Anne's Chambers just near Victoria Station with Bunny Fuchs in charge and Todd as his sidekick, and a typist, and that was all. And, well, that was before the days of almost anybody having heard of the Transantarctic Expedition, and they were very informal and they were great fun, and one of my jobs was to sort of take things there, discuss maps, symbols and that sort of thing with them.
What did you make of Fuchs?
Well, great fun, but I knew him before Transantarctic, and I think inevitably fame and things changed him a bit. And it certainly put a bigger gulf between him and post-TAE FIDs. You know, he was Sir Vivian then. Mm. Whereas when I knew him, he was just Dr. Fuchs or Bunny, well, to everybody. And really, except slightly older than other people on the base, not that different.
Let's go back to how the maps were made. These chaps would go off for 2.5 years with their theodolites. Would you hear from them again in 2.5 years?
At the end of the 2.5 years.
During?
Not really, no, not during.
So they weren't sending things back to you?
No, no.
They came back.
They would have maybe had a revised programme. I mean, the programmes in those days were largely to do with where there were gaps on the maps, which happened to be near where they could reach. And the way they did it was really left to them. The early ones, well, Derek had a geography degree as well and had done rather more surveying, but he went for his astro training before a sort of crash course on the roof of the Royal Geographical Society with Alfred Stevenson. And that was through the clouds and fog of London.
Small.
He always did find astro rather difficult. So the early training of those FIDs, the earliest ones, of course, were ex-army wartime RE surveyors and that sort of thing. So they really were much more competent than the next batch, which probably started about 53-ish, until they did start getting better quality surveyors. I mean, obviously that's a generalisation. There was great variety in it.
So just going back to that point then, they would go off for 2.5 years, they'd come back, and they would then try and finalise those maps in your offices.
They would come to the office, yes. And they would work for anything from a fortnight to 3 or 4 months. And the computing section would take charge of their computations and that sort of thing. Despair in certain respects.
Difficult to go back and check anything, isn't it?
Yes, but I think, I mean, I have a great deal of time for TOS. It was almost an inspirational institution in the early days. It was set up by Martin Houghton immediately after the war for the purpose of surveying the British colonies and eventually the other sort of concerns, yes. And everybody was focused on that. And although there were lots of rows and things, it was a great deal of dedication from virtually everybody, from the lowest to the highest. And I lived through that period, and I have that only. And when I talk to people from DOS now, they say, oh, yes, but you don't know how it changed when, you know, we were being disbanded or possibly sent to Glasgow and various other ideas that Margaret Thatcher had for them. I think it was partly because it was immediately post-war and there was still a sense of everybody pulling together. And that is a big contrast to me for how BAS developed, where I don't think everybody has always been pulling together there. But, the surveyors, and I still refer to them as my surveyors, the one that came when I was there, and Barbara McHugo, who took over from me and lasted much longer and was much more adept at her survey and things, in fact became the first woman director at the Ordnance Survey when they moved there. She took over from me and, they were on a much higher technical level when she was dealing with them, and she wrote this book about the topographical surveys in FIDS.
So they would be there in your office with their pencils and their rubbers?
That's right.
Trying to make sense of 2.5 years of research?
Exactly that, yes.
Were they coming to you to say, what do I do now?
Not so much technically, because they would go to the computing section. But to a certain extent, yes.
You were a mother hen, were you?
Slightly, yes. Okay. Yes. They were great. I mean, they were great fun.
How were the maps? Were they hand-drawn with mapping pens?
What, you mean before they were printed?
Yeah.
Well, yes. I mean, all Ordnance Survey and were hand-drawn and then with more and more technical aids coming in. But yes, I mean, mapping today is a complete closed book as far as I'm concerned. Mm. Once GPS came in and you could find your position on the Earth's surface without having to go into very complicated calculations, the whole thing changed. And it stopped really quite abruptly. I suppose, in the 80s, probably.
Yeah.
I mean, I retired. Well, Derek came back from Horseshoe Island in 1957. And we married at the end of that year. And I left DOS at the very beginning of 1960. So all those new innovations came in afterwards. And I never needed to know. And I don't think I would have ever got my little mind round it.
It must have been, mapping the Antarctic must be very, very difficult because, A, half of it's moving all the time.
No, not really. I mean, the ice coastline might be moving a bit, but no, it isn't moving. Mapping was not in that sort of detail. I mean, the errors could be sort of 50 miles out in my early days. And if you got it on a map, it was there for people to say, but that's not right. But then they started saying that's not right. You know, it was easier to have the wrong thing down on a map. It wasn't as though somebody was going to lose their way by it because nobody was going to those parts. I mean, the idea was to cover the whole peninsula at 200,000, which we did. And there were would be maps with just one round loop for an island and a bit of ice shelf coast, and that would be that sheet printed. It, in a way, it was a waste of money and time, but it was politically quite useful.
Well, do they resemble Pooh's map of 100 Acre Wood there?
No. If you knew something about maps, you could realise it was very generalised. But yeah. No, they were perfectly proper maps. And one thing we did on the early days, which all the surveyors' sledge journeys from which they made the maps, particularly the ones south from Marguerite Bay, were plotted on the maps so that somebody coming after them could know where they had been. And it would be easier for them to journey that way or to make corrections or whatever. And the map and survey library at DOS, where these other people who were recruited with me worked, kept all these records and supplied them and informed the new surveyors when they came to do their work. From the Inland Revenue, a small office in
Kilburn,
to the atmosphere at DOS, especially with this floating in and out of surveyors, was great fun. It was marvellous, actually.
How big was the print run? Because you weren't going to sell any.
No, probably 200 upwards, 200 up to 1,000 maybe, depending on that. Yes, some were quite small. And the Ordnance Survey, that was another bit of liaison I had. The Ordnance Survey did all our printing. Mm. So that was... they used to... When any map that was produced, I mean, event of the colonies, used to take a little journey around most of the offices at DOS, looking for everybody to look over to find mistakes. And you'd have your cup of coffee pouring over a map and sort of just annotate it around the margins. And They very much encouraged other people to take the initiative to say, is this right to change this sort of thing?
What about the naming of landmarks? Because was that you mentioned earlier that sometimes that had to be resolved as well.
Yeah, well, that was very much... You've heard of Brian Roberts, probably. He was very much... He'd been on the British Graham Land expedition, and he had... the Antarctic at heart. There was quite a lot of friction between him and Fuchs. Well, it may have been in the early run-up to the Transantarctic expedition. And I had to deal quite a bit with both of them. But they were both perfectly easy to deal with, and I think the friction was a little bit more imagined than possibly real. They had different goals. Brian Roberts's was to develop British Antarctic territory, to get it mapped, and he was really behind the air survey of 1955-6. And the money. And I think it was the fact that the money that was needed for that could be in conflict with the money that was put into the Transantarctic expedition. I think possibly in the end both was forthcoming, but you know, that was a slight source of problems. But he was meticulous in the way any name was placed, that there could be absolutely no doubt what it referred to. And I used to take these maps up there and we'd pore over them and then go and have lunch in a pub and go back and pore over them again. I was fortunate because I lived in North London, and I travelled daily to Tolworth. So the Foreign Office and Victoria were on my route home. And so I think there was no sort of friction about me having time off to do this quite a lot. In their separate ways, I really got on very well with both of them, actually, and liked them both very much.
So how were names chosen? Were we into the era of naming things after the people who worked there?
Well, yes, but there aren't anything like enough. If they worked in the field, in the early days, they inevitably had a name for them, after them. Or if they had close associations with it, if they had done work to do with maps or geology or some sort of field thing, Brian Roberts would suggest that they had, that such and such was now. Well, I don't know that he suggested it. He said it would be, and like it or lump it. It got... There was a vast amount of mapping. I mean, the surveyors were down there. They were finding new mountain ranges, and they all had peaks and valleys and glaciers and the whole thing.
Well, there was a shortage of names.
Absolutely, yes. So they would go into themes like Antarctic air navigators or constellations or all sorts of slightly weird and wonderful names. But to a certain extent, they had a purpose because they were generally grouped in an area. I know Derek got into great trouble over this, well, trouble with a lot of FIDs, because he did his second trip to the Antarctic when I met him in Port Stanley. He, after that, he came back and used some American air photography, some oblique photography, from Ronnie's expedition, which was very good photography, but it had never been used, and it was completely haphazard in the flight lines they took. They just sort of wandered about all over Alexander Island and South Peninsula. And he spent a couple of years at Birmingham putting what he could get out of these into a map. It was before the era of satellite images, so there was no guidance elsewhere. And then he spent about 3 months at the Foreign Office getting all these things named. And in desperation, they suggested a musical theme that would have almost endless things. So just about everything in Alexander Island that wasn't named before has got a musical theme. And it maddens most of the Finns. So... But now that was a slightly later development when he was working at Birmingham. I'd left the US.
So naming of landmarks was a fairly casual affair. Didn't go to committee. It wasn't scrutinised.
Oh yes, but Ryan Brothers was the secretary of the Antarctic Place Names Committee. Right. But I don't think anybody dared to quarrel. Oh, I mean, he'd done so much research on it, and he had so much Antarctic background himself that I think it all just went tick 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 tick, and it was approved.
Did you get to deal with these aerial photographs yourself?
The obliques and things.
Yeah.
They only came into our possession at DOS fairly late in my time there. I think it was something about 59. They resulted from the time, in fact, when Jonathan Bolton's father was down there.
Okay.
Yes. When Ronnie and the British were all on Stonington Island for that year, and the Americans had the aeroplanes and the money, and the Brits had the dogs and a few more safety ideas. And they did work together after a few sort of spats and things beforehand. But the idea was that we would supply them with the survey detail to use the photos, and they would supply us with a copy of the photos. And Brian Roberts spent years trying to get those out of the Americans and eventually succeeded, which was more or less as I was leaving. And that was one reason why Derek took on this, it was a two-year task, actually, making this map and doing various other things from it. We had quite a lot of casual photos, and the surveyors took photos on their trips, and they would, from the ground make pans and just put them together and sort of have a range of mountains and mark them off, and Brian Roberts would use those. So he was very careful about things being named. And now, I think they are still careful. He produced maps at 200,000 from our series, on which every name was placed in exactly the right place, and everybody had to follow that. I think on the whole it worked, actually.
Tell me a little bit more about Derek. How did you meet your future husband?
Well, we were both recruited on this hierarchy of nine for the geographers for the library and
started on the same day?
We started on the same day, yes. And I, reading his diary the other day, I discovered it was the 10th of September 1953. And he died just 2 days short of 50 years of that I would have known him, actually. He had got a geography degree from Sheffield, but after being nearly 3 years in the army in Germany at the end of the war. So he went to university as a mature student and did quite well at Sheffield. Did a teaching diploma, but never taught. And then started at DOS on the same day. But he was only there, well, less than 18 months before he went off to the Antarctic. And then came home and went to UCL, London, to do the postgraduate survey diploma for a year when I was still working at DOS. I was the only breadwinner in those days. in fact, he even had to pay his fees to go there. And then I didn't think he was basically a surveyor, actually, but geographers do struggle to know what to do with themselves a bit. And then he was invited by Bass, as they were then, to accompany Professor David Linton. Have you heard of him? He was Derek's professor at Sheffield and was at that point moving to be head of geography of the department at Birmingham, but had got a sabbatical year and had... it actually all sprang from the fact that Brian Roberts wanted a physiological survey of using the Huntings air photos of 1955, which were detailed vertical ones of the northern peninsula and islands.
This was under Fidassi, wasn't it?
Yes. Using those photos to make a sort of a resume of what the country was for political reasons or whatever. But anyway, it was Brian Roberts who instigated this. And this was sort of floated around as to who might do this. And I think Bill Sloman was sort of commissioned when he went round on his recruiting trips to universities to sort of mention it, this. Well, he mentioned it at Sheffield, asked David Linton if he would, you know, if he had any ideas. And I think he he pricked up his ears and said, "Oh, I think I'd like to do that." Anyway, he said, "I will do it." But he needed a sidekick to look after him, and he and Derek had always got on very well. So Derek was recruited for this. I think Derek was quite excited to be going back again just for a summer. I mean, we'd only been married about 9 months. Anyway, Bill Sloman, who did a lot for me and was very, very kind to me, thought, "Oh, well, why don't we send Petra down to Port Stanley at the same time to sort out the maps?" There was quite a lot of survey stuff in Stanley. Sort that out and see what was useful and generally give her a little trip. Bill, you've obviously heard lots about Bill Sloman. Wonderful man to 95% of people. Just a few didn't think so. Anyway, he arranged all this and I dithered a bit. I thought, "Oh, I don't know about this." Anyway, I think I stranded him slightly because he was telling everybody that I wanted to go and he was making the arrangements. And I was sort of on the point of almost letting him down on this and turning round and saying, "I'm not sure." But anyway, I did decide to go. And he arranged for me to go down on the Totten, which was going down to Halley to relieve the... I think it was the end of the international geophysical year before it was handed over to Bass as Halley base. Anyway, the Totten was commissioned to take that lot down, and there was a spare cabin, and I was put in it. Well, technically. But then Sir Raymond Priestley, who was in charge at Bass in those days, because Bunny was on the Transantarctic, thought, no, not well, not even my dead body. And he vetoed it. So I was booked to go down on the AES, was a little cargo boat, a little Danish cargo boat that plied between Europe and the Falkland Islands. It had 9 passengers, and I was one of them. So that's an experience in itself.
How do you mean?
Well, there was one Dane who had gone back to... He lived in the Falklands most of his life, but he had been the first to see the German battleship in the First World War off the Falklands. And I think, I'm not sure of the story, but he'd alerted everybody. And he had gone back to Denmark in 1958, as it was then, to receive a medal from the king, taking with him his wife, his daughter, who was married to a Falkland Islander. Well, they were virtually Falkland Islanders themselves. And then there was one girl who was going out to marry a Falkland Islander and some lads who were going out to work on a sheep farm. So they were we were rather a mixed bunch, but it was quite fun. And
so you got there in the end?
Oh, yes, I got there in the end, yes.
What was your impression of the place?
Of the Falklands? Mm. Well, I'd heard so much about it. I think it was more or less as I expected it to be.
Okay.
But I arrived about a week before Christmas and stayed, and Derek was south then with Linton, and stayed till the end of January. So I was there for all the high days, holidays, and everything that was going on. And I just had a wild, exciting time. It was off on a little ship here to Kidney Island one day, off somewhere else. I went over to Bluff Cove and Fitzroy. And, I mean, it was parties at Government House, parties here, there and everywhere.
Why did you not get any further south?
Well, women didn't go to further south then. It just was not done. I mean, Sir Raymond was... Well, he was from the heroic age, and women stayed at home and waited for their men to come back again. I don't think women started going south until... Well, certainly till Bunny had retired. I don't think Bunny was against it. I think probably Dick Laws was against it as well, actually. But I think they probably did go. And for one thing, the accommodation on the newer ships was much more suitable. And, in fact, they would just... I think the ones who did go, Anne Todd and some others, I think they journeyed round on the ship, saw the bases, and came home. But I saw a lot of life in the Falkland Islands, which I kept a diary of that time, and it was a really exciting change, different thing for me. And I was in occasional radio contact with Derek further south.
Where was he? He was...
Well, they were mostly in the South Shetlands and Girlash Strait and Hope Bay. Round there. He did have a little stint at Hope Bay and did a bit more dog driving there, which I think was a big thrill to sort of get his hands on dogs again.
How did you get married? Where?
Sorry?
Where and how did you get married?
Oh, we got married in Northwood, Middlesex, my home, with some Fids around as best man and that sort of thing. No, it was all very conventional.
You stayed in the Mapping World quite a long time.
Well, I only stayed then. I mean, when I only stayed from getting back from this trip to Port Stanley, I only stayed just less than a year. For one thing, we had got leave, unpaid leave, to travel in South America for 6 weeks. We slightly overstayed our stint, but I mean, in those days we were travelling cheap, and we came back. We came back from Lima on a ship which we had booked before we went out, which was always a slight hazard. But would we get there? cost us £79 for our voyage home, with all found. And I went back to work, and Derek went off to Birmingham to start this map business. And, well, I handed in my notice at the end of 59, beginning of 60. And then retreated with a baby to to Birmingham.
You sallied forth again later, didn't you?
Well, yes, I had 24 years at home bringing up a family. And then Bill Sloman rang me up out of the blue. I mean, we did see quite a lot of the Slomans from time to time. And said, your old job's moving to Cambridge, are you interested? Because that was the time when DOS was being disbanded and what was left except the Antarctic stuff was going to Southampton and the rest was going to Cambridge. So I had this interview and there was a panel of three, one of whom was Eric Salmon, who was an old friend. Another was the official civil service one. Another was my future boss. And I know I was only voted in by 2-1.
We're talking about Charles Swithenbank.
Yes. And he afterwards told me who he had wanted.
But did you get on with him?
Yes.
That's a qualified yes, isn't it?
Yes, it's a qualified yes. I think this is, I mean, I had nearly 5 years at Bass before. I was 55 when I went there. And I arrived in this big organisation, of which I'd known it as a tiny organisation, full of young men going in all directions and pieces of paper flying about in all directions. And I'm sure their attitude was, who on earth's this old woman who's coming? I was put, to begin with, because the room I was going to have wasn't available, I was put in a big room with several young geologists and a visiting geological professor from New Zealand, my first day. And nobody actually told me what to do or anything. And at 11 o'clock, they all got up with their mugs. Nobody said, come and have coffee with us. Nobody said, you know, do you know where the... I didn't even know really where the dining room was. And that attitude stuck with me a little bit. It wasn't the sort of we're all in it together that I had known at DOS. Well, it wasn't at DOS in those days. You know, time had moved on and the wartime spirit, which did last then, had gone. I mean, Bass was a lovely place to work. And the material that was coming to me from DOS was new to everybody at Bass. There were no surveyors in those days. The survey as such had finished. And so I knew actually more about the material than anybody else there. So, and really what I was not doing anything very creative. I was holding and maintaining the air photos, maps, satellite images for the... anybody who wanted to use them. And I had a complete stream of people coming in. Can I have this? Can I have that? So I was very much a map library librarian there, which was fine. And it was just before Bass really got round to any mapping of its own, which they now do. But and it was also the very early days of satellite imagery, actually, which was a good thing because... there was quite a lot of technicality I would probably not have picked up again.
Well, I was going to say, there was a 24-year gap in technology, wasn't there? So you must have...
Yes, but I didn't... The actual maintenance of material... I'd got a geographical mind. I could find things. I could understand them and read them. I was less strong in the production of them, but at that time it didn't really matter. So I think I've... filled a useful slot, but probably retired at the appropriate moment.
So you're a woman of your own time, twice?
In a way, yes. But the satellite images, I mean, that was had a big significance on the map Derek made of Alexander Island. I mean, if you've read the papers he wrote on it, about how it was produced, you would realise it was sort of really basic mapping from almost nothing. Well, along came the satellite images, and of course told you everything about where the surrounding islands were. There was one particular island, Letardi Island, which you could say Derek discovered because it was not on any previous map. And Ronnie had never used them, had never carefully looked at them. And it required quite a lot of careful use to see that Letardi Island, which is south of Sharko Island, were two separate islands and they had been mistaken for the same thing. And Derek had mapped the eastern end of it, which was all you could see from the air photos, and sort of made it a relatively small island, because a good geographer doesn't draw something in that they can't see. Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, it's a very big island, and it was much bigger than that. Along come the satellite images, and they were rather scuppered Derek's map in many ways.
So the satellite imaging was sweeping away all that heroic historic surveying, wasn't it?
Yes, but it wasn't that detailed. A surveyor who'd done a detailed map, the actual juxtaposition of one geographical feature was to another was perhaps not as accurate because of their ground survey. But often the detail was more than certainly we could get out of the early satellite images. I'm sure you can get it out now, but you couldn't in the 80s.
So the 80s satellites were supplementing the earlier work, not replacing it?
Well, in some ways they were replacing them because they were making maps photographed with using the satellite images sort of laid together to make a map. And they were, well, to my mind, they were very crude. They probably, well, they certainly had their uses, but you really needed both to get a good map. And now they're using both.
Some of the notes I've been given about you, Peter, say that you were very rigorous in your map production.
I, personally, I'm not sure that I have produced any maps, actually, whether I'm rigorous or not.
Well, sorry, very rigorous in your approach to map production. Other people's, I guess.
Well,
are you a quality control?
Insofar as it was, yes. I mean, I would apply the rules rigorously could be applied. Yeah. Yes, probably. But they were usually other people's rules, like Brian Roberts's or the mapping people at Tolworth.
You're here at Bowness on a FID reunion for Marguerite Bay. Are you a FID?
Well, no, I'm not a FID, because technically a FID is somebody who's wintered in the Antarctic, but there are becoming fewer and fewer technical FIDs, and they're mostly biologists or electricians or somebody who maintains a base. I don't think anybody's... I'm not aware that anybody's actually defined what a FID is.
Do you feel like one?
No, but I certainly feel a close association with innumerable FIDs, actually.
You've been, haven't you, now, to the Antarctic? You finally made it.
I finally made it, yes, and I'm so glad I did. And interestingly, Derek didn't really want to go.
This was in 2005?
2005. He wanted to remember Horseshoe Island. I mean, he was the first at Horseshoe Island, and the eight of them built the base. And he was base leader the second year. He wanted to remember it with the dogs on the span and life going on there. I don't think he really wanted to see it mothballed. And I'm not sure he would have enjoyed it that much, actually. So,
okay. Sadly, he didn't get to go. And you had to decide whether to go or not.
Yes.
What was your thinking?
I didn't know closely anybody who was going, and I needed somebody to share a cabin with. And I preferred to have somebody I knew who, rather than to be put with somebody. And I had a friend, well, I have a friend who I hadn't known very long, and Derek and I had met at the Scott Polar Institute, who had great interest in the Antarctic, and for whom money was no problem, and had been on a couple of trips anyway. And by chance, the first autumn lecture at the Scott Polar, which I went to if they were interested from time to time, was by Charles. And this friend rang me up and said, would you like to come and stay the weekend and come with me? Because it's always difficult when you lose somebody to launch forth on your own. Very difficult, actually. I don't think people realise how difficult it is. And when I was there, I thought, well, supposing I asked Mary to come. And she leapt about 6 feet in the air and said, yes, please, I'm coming.
So how was it when you went to Horseshoe and you saw this place that Derek had talked about?
It was all right. We had a sort of calm, slightly overcast whole morning there. And I just walked about on my own. I didn't want to be with anybody, just sort of taking in, you know, much of which I knew, actually, trying to imagine what it was like. It was all right. I'm very glad we went, and also very glad we got to Stonington, about which I'd heard so much from the surveyors who'd been there. And Derek. Well, no, not really Derek, because he hadn't. He did just get there, but hardly. But it was only just over a year after he died, and I don't think I'd really sort of found myself after that. You know, I think it's been a long process, actually, of which Fitz has helped enormously, because I just love being with people and talking Antarctic and Fitz and things like that, and they've been great companions. And on that trip, of course, I got to know lots of people much better. But there's some of the old friends, like Ken Blakelock and Peter Hooper, the ones who were down with Derek, have also been good friends as well. Dick Taylor. I think you have, you know some of those, don't you?
So you are a Fid, really.
What is a Fid?
We'll leave it there, shall we?
Yes.
Hanging in the air.
Yes.
Thank you very much indeed.